You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, January 8th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, 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 everyone.
Hello.
Well, hello, Mr. Deltoid. What's up?
I was on this weekend, and for the first time in about, probably 15 years, I sat down and watched it from beginning to end.
Clockwork Orange.
And wow, it's a tour de force.
Really. Did you video well, little brother?
A little bit of the ultraviolence.
That movie, you'd think that it wouldn't age well because of just how weird and it seems like it was like very much shot in the 70s. It has a very intense 70s feel
to
it.
Weird does age well because it isn't really anchored in any particular time.
Hey, Jay, happy Bedford Day.
Awesome. Thank you for reminding me.
What's a Bedford?
A Bedford is a cryonically preserved man.
What?
On January 12th, 1967, Dr. James Bedford became the first person to be cryonically suspended following his death from cancer at the age of 73. The Life Extension Society offered anybody the chance to be the first person to be frozen, and they said free of charge. So it was quite the deal. Bedford was accepted. And it's nice to think of this as like a happy Futurama-esque type thing where he died, and then he was carefully packed up and placed in a container where he remains to this day. Unfortunately, the job was pretty well botched, apparently. Robert Nelson of the Cryonic Society of California took the lead on it, but he was missing for an hour after Bedford died. He eventually came around, and he and his cohorts injected Bedford with all the necessary chemicals, laid dry ice on him, and packed him up and shuttled him from place to place as hijinks ensued, apparently, like a Weekend at Bernie's sequel set in the Arctic. Within the week, Bedford's family could apparently tell how inept Nelson was, and they took control of the body, which was smart because in the following decade, Nelson would be sued for allowing 9 bodies to thaw without telling anybody. The family ended up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars just to maintain Bedford's body while fighting with various cryonics organizations before at last Alcor Life Extension Program stepped in and offered to take him in. Remarkably, throughout all of that, Bedford's body did appear to have been kept frozen through all of his wacky adventures. However, the chemicals that he was injected with probably did not prevent ice crystals from forming or in any way protect his brain. So at this point, he's probably just a well-preserved frozen meat potato. But he's a well-preserved frozen meat potato of historical import. Happy Bedford Day.
There had to be a first, right?
And he's still at Alcor.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, a contract's a contract. They have to live up to their obligation.
I wouldn't just say that. I mean, the people at Alcor absolutely have a commitment to preserving life. And, you know, they knew that this person wanted to be frozen.
Well, the real heroes of the story are Bedford's family, I think, because his family apparently didn't even, I think it was mostly his son, his daughter-in-law, and his wife. And apparently they didn't even really believe that this was going to work. But they were really committed to honoring his final wishes. So, you know, I mean, that's a crazy thing. Can you imagine spending all of that money on chemicals and upkeep just to keep the body of your loved one frozen when you don't even think that's actually going to do anything just because that's what he wanted before he died? It's kind of amazing.
Bob, speaking of freezing temperatures, I read on the internet that scientists have produced a temperature lower than absolute zero. And I know that science reporting on the internet can't be misleading.
Oh my God.
So that's pretty exciting.
Shut up.
So frustrating. If you, like Steve was saying, if you believe a lot of these news stories, scientists are saying that they have, what do I have here? They've gone faster than the speed of light. No, wait, that's not it. No, they've actually created temperatures colder than absolute zero, which this has lots of parallels with the breaking the speed of light. You know, so many people are reporting it's got to be true, right? All right, let me just give you some examples. Device.com, a site that I like a lot, wrote in a post, scientists have created a gas colder than absolute zero. And Geekosystem said that, take that, Lord Kelvin. Researchers create gas particles colder than absolute zero. And it just rankles me every time I read that over and over and over. Now, here are some good titles. Here are some of the good titles that I came across. New Scientist had one. Cloud of Atoms Goes Beyond Absolute Zero. Now, beyond is much better. It's not perfect, but it's much better than going below zero, because beyond kind of has lots of other implications to it. And my favorite was from Ars Technica. Their title was Entropy Drop. Scientists create negative temperature system. And that's really the crux of it right there.
That's the only accurate description of all the things you've said.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Beyond I could deal with, because in a sense, you can think of it as going beyond, but below is kind of pisses me off. So,
did you guys find these to be subtle differences or extreme sort of differences in descriptions of what was going on? Because I had a hard time following it too, and I thought it was more on the subtle side.
Some of the articles were actually fairly decent in some of the details, but they clearly said at the beginning that they made temperatures colder than absolute zero, which they absolutely did not do. Just having that one sentence in your article is enough to ruin it for me, because it just shows that you really did not do your research and you don't understand. As little as I understand, you understand even less. So let's go over what the scientists did or did not do. These scientists were from the University of Munich in Germany. They cooled 100,000 atoms to a few billionths of a degree Kelvin, nanokelvin. Now we should dive into Kelvin just a little bit. I'm sure most everyone has heard about the Kelvin temperature scale. The important thing is that it's very different from Celsius and Fahrenheit that everyone's used to, because it's an absolute temperature scale. The coldest temperature is zero. Bam, that's it. By definition, it doesn't get any colder than zero. Otherwise, this is known as absolute zero, of course, and this is the point at which all thermal motion stops. And for a little bit of perspective, it's that's minus 459 or so degrees Fahrenheit, and minus 273 or so Celsius.
And the pedantic point that we often get called on.
Because I said degrees. You don't have to say degrees. Just say
there are no degrees Kelvin. It's just Kelvin.
Yeah. So it's considered impossible then to actually reach absolute zero, which pretty much everyone was just ignoring in these articles. One reason, this was an interesting take. It would take infinite energy to remove that last iota of heat. Kind of like exceeding the speed of light. You get diminishing returns. It takes more and more energy to have, less and less significant gain. So it's kind of like that with removing heat and making things colder. It takes more energy, and eventually you would need infinite energy to remove that last bit.
But worse than that, Bob, is that you can't be going slower than stopped, right? I mean, so conceptually, there's no such thing as below absolute zero on that scale.
But there's no quantum equivalent of that. I mean, there's no quantum way to go about.
Well, actually, it's even worse. It's even worse if you look at it from a quantum mechanical point of view. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says that there's a minimum amount of uncertainty in an atom's position and momentum. So if you know where your atom, you have to know where your atom is in an experiment. So you have to know its position to a certain level of exactitude. But that means that the momentum will have lots of uncertainty. So therefore, there's always going to be this little bit of uncertainty in the movement, which means that there's going to always be some heat, and reaching absolute zero is impossible.
Yeah, because if an atom was at absolute rest, then you would know exactly its position and momentum.
Right, which is impossible, and which is a limitation of nature itself, not our instrumentality or our technology. It's beyond that. Yeah. So back to the scientists. So they cool these atoms. They put them in a vacuum, of course, to kind of isolate them from the environment and other heat sources. And they used a web of laser beams and magnetic fields to keep the atoms in this sort of lattice arrangement and to control how they behaved. Now, they altered their behavior in such a way that they created, in essence, another state of matter. Another state that scientists unfortunately describe as negative temperature. And I don't like negative in this situation, because there's just so much baggage with it, because everyone thinks, minus 5 Celsius, minus 5 Fahrenheit. I mean, the people know, intuitively know that you can go beyond and, you know, or below zero, but you can't do that with Kelvin. And that's, so it's got a lot of problems with it that people just are having a hard time just thinking, well, so what? Oh, they went below zero. Not a big deal. I do that every day in the winter. But when you talk about negative temperature, that's when things get a little bit wacky. It's negative in that the pattern of the distribution of energy is inverted when you compare that pattern to positive temperature. This is the Boltzmann distribution is the distribution of energies of atoms with a positive temperature. Negative temperature is the opposite. It's inverted. So that's kind of where negative comes in. It's not negative as in below zero. It's negative in that it's the distribution is just the kind of different. So here's a good way to understand it. When you have positive temperature, which is temperature that we know of, that we deal with every day. It's regular temperature that you heard of before you probably even read this article. Positive temperature will always have most of the particles in question in a low energy state with a decreasing number in higher states. Okay? So no matter how hot things get, you're always going to have most of those atoms in a lowish energy state with a number of other a fewer amount of atoms in that higher energy state. So that's positive temperature. Negative temperature is the exact opposite. Most of the particles are in the highest possible energy state with fewer and fewer in the lower energy states. Bam. That's it. That's negative temperature. It doesn't sound that bizarre when you look at it that way. Although it's not classical. You need a quantum system to really see this. You're not going to see this on some really cold planet in outer space or pretty much anywhere else. This is something that I don't think they even thought they could do this years ago. I didn't even think they thought they could actually pull this off because it's such a quirky, unusual thing, and you need quantum mechanics to actually do it. So this temperature realm then wasn't created by slowly cooling atoms more and more until you got below absolute zero. If you think of absolute zero as the low point of a valley between mountains, what they did was not to dig a little bit deeper in that valley. What they did is make it so that in one step you moved from the valley to the low point of the valley to the peak of a mountain in just one step. So that's kind of,
what do you mean by one step, Bob?
Because what they did was they took this system of atoms and they brought it to very close to absolute zero. And then using the laser beams and magnetic fields, they tweaked it in such a way to give most of the particles, their maximum amount of energy that they could attain in that system. So they went from a very low energy, cold system to a much higher energy, stable system in one step.
The other thing that, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, is that because it was in a vacuum and isolated as it was, once the atoms were in that inverted distribution where they were mostly in a high energy state, because now we're talking about a different property, and it's a thermodynamic property of the distribution of energy. It would have had to have spontaneously decreased its entropy in order to spread out, and it didn't have the energy to do that. And so it was sort of stuck in that state.
Right. And that was the key to these atoms exhibiting, this negative temperature effect. That was absolute key. Without their artificial manipulation of those atoms using, their technology, the lasers and magnetic fields, they would never have been able to pull this off. But they did show that they can create this realm of negative temperature. And this isn't just a weird little, lab experiment. This is real. This is definitely something that exists.
This occurs naturally, Bob?
No, but it's negative temperatures may result from a quirk in our technical definition of temperature when you bring in thermodynamics and energy. But the behavior of these systems are bizarre and they are very real. So this is a real thing. And the potential, I think, is really, really fascinating. For example, the negative temperatures kept the cluster of atoms from collapsing, which has some similarities to dark energy and how it's preventing the universe from collapsing. So we might actually get some insight into dark energy from these the negative temperature realm here. Another one is that the negative temperatures could be used to create these really bizarre, hyper-efficient heat engines. Really wild stuff. They could potentially not only absorb energy from hotter substances, but they could absorb energy from colder ones also at the same time. Really kind of counterintuitive things that heat engine based on this technology could potentially do. Another thing is that a cloud of these negative temperature atoms, they would actually, in a sense, defy gravity. They would float up instead of floating down, as you would think. So there's a lot of meat to this topic. If you're even a little interested, I recommend just going to a bunch of websites, especially Ars Technica had a great discussion of this. Read the some of the original work from the authors, and it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it's very definitely esoteric, but that one concept I think that really makes it is the thermodynamic distribution of the energies. And once you sort of get that, then it all seems to make sense.
Right.
All right, let's come down to earth, I guess, a little bit. Rebecca, tell us about the Houston Cancer Quack.
Happy birthday, Stanislaw Brzezinski.
Who, by the way, was my jackass of the year for 2012.
That's right. If our listeners recall two long episodes ago, we did talk about Brzezinski. He's the jerkwad who sells phony, quote-unquote, cures to people with cancer at a very steep price in Houston. And he has also, of course, threatened to sue tons of people who criticize him, including skeptical teenage hero Reese Morgan.
Yep. So, and others who call him jerkwad. And others like...
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to my letter from his lawyers. So, yeah, some skeptics are doing something about it. If you go to thehoustoncancerquack.com, you will see information on the fact that on January 23rd, it's Stanislaw Brzezinski's 70th birthday. And to mark that occasion, skeptics are attempting to raise at least $30,000, which they will donate to St. Jude Children's Hospital for kids with cancer. And what they're doing is they're hoping to attract a bit of media attention to this, and also to challenge Brzezinski to match those funds in order to help kids with cancer, as opposed to ripping off people of all ages with cancer, as he currently does. The $30,000 mark was chosen because that's about the cost of what Brzezinski charges for his antineoplastin therapy. Is that how you say it?
Antineoplastin, yeah.
So yeah, 30 grand is what that costs. So wouldn't it be cool if we could raise $30,000 and then go to him and say, will you match this? Will you actually help kids with cancer? I'm not expecting him to match it, but what we can do is raise some money for a good cause while hopefully turning a bit of a media spotlight onto Brzezinski in the hopes that more people will call him out. Maybe he will be further investigated. Maybe we can prevent more people from getting ripped off.
Hey, is there any chance that he is going to pony up 30 grand and kind of turn it to his advantage in a sense and say, hey, I'm not such a bad guy after all. Look at me. I love children too and all that stuff.
Well, you know, if he does, then great for children with cancer. I mean, it's kind of a win-win on our end because
does he look like a sympathetic figure at that point? I'm just saying, you know, but it's about, you know, we're trying to frame the debate here and let people understand exactly what's going on. Will people be sympathetic to him?
Saying will it be a PR backfire if he actually gives him money?
I can't imagine that it would be, because what this is doing is simply turning the microscope onto Brzezinski. Because once we show what he's actually doing, regardless of whether or not he ponies up the $30,000, more media attention on what he's doing means that he's going to be called out, that he won't be able to perpetuate his little scam.
Well, we hope. I mean, the evidence suggests that more media attention might actually drive more patients to his clinic.
That's true. That could happen.
We can't really guarantee that that's not the case. But it is, I mean, you know, they're trying to frame the question in a loaded way that's sort of a no-win for him. It's like, will you finally do something to really help cancer patients? You know, it's like, have you stopped beating your wife yet? There's no question that you could give to that. There's no answer you can give without calling into question, you know, the question itself. But
yeah, and
whatever.
I noticed that all of the information that they're sending out in order to promote this effort includes extensive information on Brzezinski's unethical trials and things like that. And even actual descriptions of what's happened to people who have been ripped off by him. So,
yeah.
You know, patient stories. So
it's amazing that he's been able to skirt by for decades.
So yeah, I mean, all of this is going out to media outlets, and I don't know, I'm hopeful that we can actually catch someone's eye, you know, get some actual investigative reports done. I've already seen some, there's some major, online outlets that have covered him, like Boing Boing. I believe it's taken him to task, Zini.
That's good.
So, yeah. So hopefully we'll get a bit more of that going. Yeah. I wish them the best of luck.
Yeah, I'm going to help them. Absolutely. It's a reasonable idea. You know, I say it couldn't hurt. I hope not. I mean, I do think he's got enough exposure. He probably has more than enough patients to treat, so it doesn't really matter if he gets more attention. You know, he's already come up against the Texas Board of Health and gotten by multiple times. I don't know what else we could do from that point of view.
Well, yeah, I mean, if there's enough public outrage, then, you know, there is more. I mean, look
maybe
how long
they'll
it
revisit
took.
It, yeah.
Yeah, look how long it took to get rid of Wakefield, you know.
Oof,
so,
12
and,
years.
And, yeah, and a lot of that came by the efforts of skeptics, you know, who didn't stop criticizing, didn't stop publicizing what he was doing.
Yeah, the only difference is that that Brzezinski's already gone through the process and got off.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they just haven't seen fit to investigate him or bring him before the Board of Health. It's been done. He just manages to slink away every time.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. I think it's just we don't have the regulatory infrastructure here to deal with people like Brzezinski. As long as, you know, you're not doing certain things like sleeping with your patients or overbilling Medicare, you know, if you're not doing those things, if you're just practicing pseudoscience, it's very difficult and in some states impossible to get doctors to act against their license or to do something be based upon that. The only thing that you're really left with is malpractice.
Yeah, malpractice.
Yeah, but then you need somebody to sue him, you know, for
malpractice. Are there any lobbying groups that are working on trying to push for legislation on things like that that you know of, Steve?
Yeah, well, there's the Institute for Science and Medicine, the ISM, of which I'm the chairman.
Never heard of them.
Yeah.
What now? We're
still getting started. It's the same cast of characters, you know, the skeptical physicians who are trying to do this. And then there are definitely, you know, local efforts in various states, but, not nearly enough. And the problem is we don't have funding. You know, this is something we do in our spare time on a shoestring budget, whereas we're fighting against people who have millions of dollars at that disposal because there's money on the other side and there isn't money on our side. Yeah. There's money in selling snake oil and pseudoscience. There's no money in calling BS on it.
Well, so maybe that should be this group's next fundraising effort.
Sure. But we're always talking about what we could be doing on our end to try to combat this. So anyway, this is a reasonable enough experiment and we'll see how it goes. And I wish it well. Let's talk about some actual medical science, though. There's been a lot of discussion I see going around in the media and blogs and elsewhere about a recent study looking at high precision genome editing. This, of course, has to do with genetic modification, genetic manipulation, right? Genetically modified, whatever. And it's
corn.
It's a basic technology in terms of how do we insert genes or gene segments into the DNA of a target organism where we want to do it, right? So we want to get the segment that we want in the place in the DNA that we want it. So we have to target it. Now there already are techniques for doing this, but they're very cumbersome, slow, and expensive. What researchers have
like
done,
viral vectors using a virus as a vector.
That's actually different. So using a viral vector is a way of trying to get a gene into a cell of a living organism, like a person. This technique is more for getting genes into cells in petri dishes. So it's different. It's a different application. This is not the kind of thing, at least not in its current form. We may develop something from this, but this is not something that you would inject into a patient. This is something you would do, but you might do it to cells that you would then inject into patients.
Right.
But so this is developed by the Broad Institute and MIT's McGovern Institute for Brain Research. What they did was they used bacterial RNA enzymes. So some bacteria have the ability to defend themselves from viruses that would insert DNA into the bacterial DNA by identifying it and snipping it out. And so the proteins essentially have sequences on them that will line up and match sequences of DNA. So that's how they target you know, where to go. And then they have the enzymes to snip that out. So by using the same suite of proteins as they've developed the technology to take a gene, to target a specific location on the DNA strand. And in fact, they could target multiple locations at the same time, which is also a huge technological advance. And then insert, you know, in a very precise way, insert the gene that they want exactly where they want it. And, again, this is not the first technology that can do this, but it's a lot quicker, cheaper, less cumbersome, than existing methods. In the 1980s, the technology essentially would add genes at random locations. We really couldn't target it. But then we developed the technique of what's called the zinc fingers technique.
I read about that on Urban Dictionary, actually.
Yeah. You add enzymes called nucleases, and you can deliver the nucleases to a specific location using a zinc finger array to target a possible sequence of DNA. But it's very limited in its usefulness because it's very cumbersome and very expensive. In any case, the new technique would make for any technology that uses this would now potentially become faster and cheaper. So what kind of technologies are we talking about? One is drug production. So a lot of many drugs are made by inserting genes into bacteria and then culturing the bacteria, and the bacteria will squirt out whatever drug, you know, you inserted the gene for in their DNA. So that's so-called recombinant technology. So of course, if you could do that multiple sequences at once, you know, much more easily, that will, you know, reduce the cost of drug manufacturing for any, you know, drug that is dependent on recombinant technology, recombinant DNA technology. Genetic modification of organisms, of course, that would help with that. Also, this would potentially be useful for many stem cell applications. This could combine with stem cell technology. There are multiple different ways to use stem cells. I think the way that most people think of when they think of stem cells is that, again, stem cells are those cells that have the potential to turn into other cells, right? So they're like immature cells, and they could be coaxed to mature along one or another developmental line to become a mature form of a specific kind of cell. So you could put in, you know, inject stem cells into the brain, you know, neural stem cells, and they would become mature neurons, and they would make new connections in the brain, or heart cells to take over damaged heart cells, or liver cells, or whatever. But that's just one type of application of stem cells. You could also use stem cells, if you could engineer them, you know, by inserting the gene to produce the protein that you want into a stem cell and then inject it into a certain tissue. It could become, in essence, a drug delivery system. They could take up shop and they could start cranking out the drug right in the tissue where it's needed. Or they could be used as enhanced support cells. Maybe they're not replacing the diseased cells, but they're helping them function better by being good support cells. So these are just a couple other different ways to use these stem cells. Or it could be useful to getting away from stem cells in cancer therapy. Let's say you take lymphocytes out of a patient. You genetically modify them to function in some way that is more efficient or more targeted, and then inject them back into the patient and they attack and kill the cancer, for example. Or one very interesting application that I read about when researching this topic, HIV therapy. So for the human immunodeficiency virus, what you could do is take the T cells out of a patient infected with HIV. Now, HIV is a virus, it's a retrovirus that is very deadly because it sort of preemptively takes out the immune system that would take out the HIV if it were functioning properly.
Yeah, so you would die of the common cold or something mundane like that.
So patients with HIV die of opportunistic infections because in addition to taking out the immune system so that it can't fight the HIV infection, you can't fight other infections either. Think about this. So you take out some of those lymphocytes, some of those T cells, and then you modify them so that the protein that the HIV uses to attach and enter the lymphocytes are altered so that they're resistant to HIV infection, and then you inject them back into the patient. Now they have resistant, HIV-resistant T cells that can, you know, reproduce and carry on their immune function and not be taken out by the HIV. So it doesn't get rid of the infection, although it would help fight it because you have an intact immune system, but it will prevent the negative effects of having HIV and give you an immune system that could make you resistant to opportunistic infection.
That's awesome. Mm.
Yeah, so again, this is one of those things that's a basic technology. It itself is not a treatment, but it could lead to many different types of treatments. It gives us more power over the genome, which is, you know, definitely one of the areas of future technology, medical technology that clearly has a lot of potential, and we're just really at the beginning of it in many ways.
One of those things I thought we'd have like 10 years ago fully functional by now, you know?
Yeah, but that's, I think I've talked about this before. I know I've written about it, the fact that this cycle is, you know, some new type of technology emerges, and then there's all the hype about what it's going to do, and then that hype fizzles over the next 5 years, and people are like, where the hell is my whatever? And then 20 years, but 20 years later, then, you know, the reality, you know, usually, or has the potential of catching up to the hype. So, like in the 80s, where were our smartphones and all, where was the internet and all that stuff that we heard about? We were waiting for it. We were disappointed. But now it's here, you know, even beyond our expectations.
Well, there's a whole generation of people that are from the 60s that are waiting for their flying cars. Everyone really believed.
Those are coming.
Something's never happened. But I think, so the internet, I think, you know, caught up with the hype.
My Little Ponies fandom. I remember in the 80s, I was all, where's the My Little Pony movies and, you know,
it's a great
conferences
example.
And things, yeah. And here they are.
Thank you for that one. I wouldn't have thought of that, Rebecca.
We're just trying to help out.
We're in the stem cell, you know, window where the reality hasn't caught up to the hype, but maybe it won't. Gene therapy, the genome project, when we cured all the diseases now that we've sequenced the genome. Well, you know, we'll get there, but.
Yeah, where's the artificial heart, right?
It's gonna take time. Yeah, I mean, these things will happen. But then there's like the hydrogen economy, maybe that will never happen. You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. But if it does, it'll be 10 years after or 15 or 20 years after everybody thought it would. Right? Certainly like in 2000, my memory is that the consensus of opinion was that by 2013, we'd be in the middle of the hydrogen economy, right?
Yeah.
And it never happened because they're still working on some basic technology. Like how do you cram that much hydrogen into a little space without it being explosive? You know?
Yeah. Now we know that we should have put all of our chips down on the electric car.
Yeah, most of science is a slow crawl, not giant leaps.
Right. But, I definitely think that we have just begun to scratch the surface of the potential of genetic manipulation for medicine. And we'll think of even new ways to exploit this kind of technology that's right. I didn't mention and no one's thinking of right now.
Can't wait to make monsters out of people.
Absolutely.
Fuzzy blue fur and stuff.
Or people out of monsters.
Ooh.
The Island of Dr. Moreau. Is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Right?
But in the meantime, I will happily accept the Skyrim MMO, which is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm. Gotta hold you over for a little while.
You say that as if you're not going to be on there till 3 in the morning with me, Steve.
Whatever.
No.
Bunch of nerds.
No, just 2 in the morning. But Evan.
Steve.
One thing that's probably not going to progress very much is the pseudoscience peddled by celebrities.
I'm picturing Steve there with a How to Segue for Dummies book. Like, I'm going to nail it for this episode.
Rebecca, I'm writing the book. Thank you.
Chart on this wall.
You know, I was looking at the notes for the podcast. I'm like, oh man, I wish I wasn't going first. With my talk, because I could have used a few extra minutes of going over it. And then I realized, of course, he had to do the segue from This Day in Science to,
Steve
to
has
the whole
a plan.
Cold thing. So it's like, yep, that's why he did it.
I hope Steve's plan is better than the freaking Cylons.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they've got a plan, and 5 seasons later, their plan was complete garbage.
What a relevant reference, though.
Thank you. See, Steve stays up late thinking of really good things like segues and how to produce the show, and I'm like, those damn Cylons!
Yes. Yes, you are his foil, Jay. Absolutely. All his hard work thrown out the window. I must tell you, the folks over at Reuters were very kind just recently in reminding their reading audience about the crazy things celebrities believe and do. The Reuters report revolves around the organization called Sense About Science, SAS, SAS is a charitable trust that equips people with the information to make sense of scientific and medical claims in public discussion. Tracy Brown, she's the managing director of SAS, had this to say. I thought it was a good quote. "We seem to be seeing a celebrity divide on science. The implausible and, frankly, dangerous claims about how to avoid cancer, improve skin, or lose weight are becoming ever more ridiculous, and unfortunately they have a much higher profile than the research and evidence," which is absolutely true. So which celebrities made the top line of the marquee of scientific ignorance in 2012? Well, we'll start with Simon Cowell, world-famous television personality, American Idol, X Factor, Teletubbies. You know, he's a bona fide king
Teletubbies
of singers and entertainers.
Yeah. Really?
Yes, he was involved in the whole Teletubbies.
He was one of the Teletubbies?
No, he was one of the producers, right?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, he helped produce.
He wasn't Tinky Winky?
If he was, he's not letting on, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I used to love the Teletubbies.
It's because you also used to smoke a lot of pot.
Yeah, you would
right, have had something to do with it.
All right.
Thank you.
Simon Cowell.
Impression. Is a regular user of oxygen shots. Mm-hmm. These are shots of oxygen in a can. Just pop one back and get all the benefits.
Right.
What are the benefits?
Well, wait. Evan, clarify. It's not liquid. Is it air? Like, what is it? Give us some more detail.
Yeah, it's gas. Yes.
So he opens
oxygen,
up like a can
gas.
And he breathes it in, right?
It's an inhaler, right? You put it up to your mouth. It's sort of like, in some instances I've seen, it's almost like a medicine that people use for asthma.
Okay. Yeah. It's like a one shot, like, shh, and you breathe it in.
Yeah.
But it's oxygen. It's pure oxygen.
It's the right? Whoop brand, right?
Whoop.
Yeah, he opens up a can of whoop gas.
Oh, boy.
No.
Yes. Yes. This is really our, like, total cheese show. Thank you, and I'm loving it. Continue.
But I love how snake oil salesman.
Look how pleased he is. You can hear it in his voice. He's so pleased with himself.
Can market oxygen and antioxidants at the same time.
It's all about balance, achieving balance in life, I suppose.
I mean, Steve, they sell water. It's one of the most purchased beverages on the planet, water.
Yeah, but it's missing my point. It's like oxygen's good for you, but it's also bad for you, so you need antioxidants to combat all the oxygen that you're getting.
It's a marketing dream, actually.
Right.
I couldn't find any scientific studies about these products that linking to the benefits of these, you know. Where is the evidence for this?
Well, if you have pulmonary disease, you may actually need oxygen.
That's right.
Yeah, but not one shot. You need a constant flow of oxygen.
We're talking about recreational use of oxygen. You're just walking around in the middle of your day. You're in the middle of
what if you're mountain climbing?
Walk.
But, Steve, that one little shot's not going to do anything.
You got to have multiple shots, but it would help.
Why are you being this way?
Hey, Mitchell.
Trying to be charitable. You know, to this
scientist.
I thought that people just, like, oxygen bars used to be all the rage five years ago or whatever. And it wasn't for health, I thought. I thought it was for the high you get.
No, it was for health. It was for health claims.
Well, supposedly for health, but.
No, because, like, oxygen bars, like, in, like, nightclubs. They would have oxygen bars.
I know, it's ridiculous. Yeah. So you go get tanked up at the first bar, then you're like, let's go to the oxygen bar. You're like, get out of here. Whatever.
Yeah, but there's some harm. There's potential harm involved with consuming oxygen. Now, maybe not so much in the sense, you know, you just take one little puff off of an inhaler. But, you know, what if, hey, if I take one puff, I may as well take five puffs because five's better than one, right? Well, Kay Mitchell from the Center for Altitude, Space, and Extreme Environment Medicine had this to say. That doctors are concerned about damage caused by oxygen levels that can get too high. This oxygen toxicity can cause cell damage, sometimes leading to death, particularly in the lungs where oxygen levels are highest, cell death, that is. And so breathing pure oxygen might cause the collapse of lung air sacs, and it might make you more susceptible to lung infection. So these are not without harm, apparently. As an added bonus, not only is Cal setting a bad example when it comes to health, he's doing the world no favors when it comes to the human being's addiction to nonsense. Cal told his Twitter followers in 2012, and I quote, "Today I had someone heal my house. Strange, but great. The healer brings in good energy. Someone told me about it. It just takes a couple of days."
Wow. It's like a feng shui kind of thing going on.
I imagine so. I mean, heal the house.
Yeah, it's so weird because when you watch him, you know, I'm sure most of us here have seen episodes of American Idol. He comes off as a very intelligent, very, very rational. Sure individual, rational. Absolutely. And like, and then there's just gaping holes in this guy's psyche that we don't see on the TV show. It, all this doesn't feel right with my, you know, how I've made him up in my head. This is not the guy, same person. It's just strange.
Do you folks know who January Jones is?
Yeah, from Mad Men.
Mad Men, yep.
She's like the most hated actress since Katherine Heigl.
I didn't know that Katherine Heigl was hated, but oh well. At least Katherine didn't make this list.
Wasn't she also she was the diamond chick from the X-Men movie, the most recent X-Men movie?
January, the gal who turned her body into...
She could turn her whole body into diamond.
Oh, yeah.
In any ways, her supplement of choice is dried placenta pills.
Oh, of course.
Placenta encapsulation is a process in which, immediately following the birth of your baby, your placenta is dehydrated and ground into a coarse powder.
Is Courtney going to be doing that, Jay?
Yeah, right?
You're going to be having placenta shakes?
We were going to have a placenta party, like more of like a barbecue type deal.
Right. Yeah.
And you'll get your invitation soon on that.
Well, I'm vegetarian, so will there be a tofacenta?
Yeah, I'm working on that. I'm trying to match the flavor right now in my kitchen, sure.
Great. Okay.
Yeah. And you could put all the capsules in a pinata, have a placenta pinata. That would be a lot of fun. Yeah, so, right, placentas, right? Dried placenta. So the mothers consume these capsules to help them rebound from the birth, supposedly, and to avoid postpartum blues, it is said. This is a scam and a potentially dangerous one, said Dr. Lauren Stryker, clinical instructor in gynecology at Northwestern Medical School, who has never heard of placenta being used as a treatment for postpartum depression. The problem here, she says, is at worst, postpartum depression can result in something horrible like suicide. And so if you're taking these pills and you think you're getting better, you're really not getting better. And, you know, there you are. You're kind of left to these sorts of thoughts in postpartum depression and other really bad things. You need some legitimate psychiatric help. These women do, and they're not getting it from these pills. So very bad, January Jones. Don't do this anymore, please. Olympic champion swimmer Michael Phelps, right?
Yeah.
The most decorated Olympian of all time with 22 medals and one slap on the wrist for marijuana use. Phelps told the Wall Street Journal in 2012 how he and his teammates used the pool as their urinal. And here's what he said. It's kind of a normal thing to do for swimmers. When we're in the water for 2 hours, we don't really get out to pee. Chlorine kills it, so it's not so bad. Yeah, that sounds good, Michael, except for one thing. There's nothing for the chlorine to kill, actually. Urine's sterile, unless something's really wrong with you, and you've got something in there you shouldn't. And it might be unappealing on many levels, but it's actually harmless. Let's see. Okay, Patsy Palmer. This is a gal I do not know, but she's a British soap opera star of some kind. And she looks kind of like a younger Anne Margaret to me. So picture that in your mind. Patsy likes to rub coffee granules onto her skin. I suppose if I had to choose between that and a coffee enema, I'd go with the granules too. But apparently it's a natural exfoliant as opposed to an unnatural exfoliant. But there are also claims that the coffee rub will help get rid of that awful unsightly cellulose. Gary Moss, a pharmaceutical scientist, points out that while caffeine may have an effect on cellulite, rubbing coffee granules onto the skin is not going to work.
Evan, celebrities also don't follow what people say. They actually come up with their own stuff. Like, take a look at Dr. Oz. The perfect example.
Try not to.
He's a celebrity, and he's also someone that is constantly spewing nonsense on his TV show. In the latest thing, I don't know if you guys got a chance to read about this, but he's been pushing really hard a very fast weight loss supplement that comes from a fruit called the Garcinia cambogia. And it looks like a little pumpkin.
What country was that?
It looks like a little pumpkin, and they extract a compound from the rind of this pumpkin, and people have been taking it to lose weight. Now, if you watch the Dr. Oz show, and if you watch the show where he talks about this, it seems that this is proven, it's safe, it's reliable, and it works amazingly well. He had a microbiologist come on, and she was talking about it, and she confirmed everything. And Dr. Oz made a point of saying that he has no personal stake in this. He just believes in it that much, and it's fantastic. Now, I watched the video a few times just to make sure I didn't miss any of the details, but if you listen to the words that he uses and the words of his, how he's describing things, he's very careful not to say anything conclusive. He lets it, the people that they interview say the things that are conclusive, so he can't be responsible for any of it. He doesn't actually put his nickel down on any of these things. He's very clever and vague about what he's saying, but it sounds impressive and it sounds very reassuring that this is the thing. Once you do some research about it, though, it was very easy for me to find that the studies that have been done on this have been poorly formed, very, very unreliable, and there were actually studies that can be trusted that said it's no better than placebo.
Yeah, the best studies show that it doesn't work, and otherwise there's just the usual spread of poor quality, poor methodological studies with results all over the place. So all consistent with it doesn't work.
So the question is, how, and more importantly, why is the information on his show and shows like his, like Dr. Oz's, where you have a famous host spewing a bunch of nonsense, why is it so wrong? Why are they even saying these things? And how could he, being a licensed physician, believe this stuff and say it? Why? And it really comes down to a very simple two-word answer. Airtime. That's it. They have to come up with content. They have to come up with content that has meaning to his particular audience. And weight loss is one of the huge things that people want to hear. A lot of these people don't even buy the product. They just want to watch TV that says, yes, you can lose that weight. They don't even lose the weight. They don't even try. They just want to hear it. It's just reassuring nonsense. Dr. Oz and his producers very easily come up with a nonstop stream of complete BS so they can sell commercial space on their station. That's it. And that's why we see these advertisements, and that's why so many famous people are spewing all this garbage.
Yeah, it sounds like this is the new acai berry that we're going to be seeing in, you know, every banner ad online. You know, lose weight in 10 days. Find out how. It's the tiny pumpkin.
Exactly. My dad got I believe it was just a cold phone call from a salesman selling one of these fruit juices that was an extract of the acai berry. And it was funny because my parents moved from the home that we all grew up in to a new house. I guess that's where they want to retire. And all of a sudden, I found all these boxes. I was helping my parents move, and a ton of these same-size cardboard boxes that had this advertisement on the outside, like a logo and everything. As soon as I laid eyes on it, I knew what it was. I was like, oh, my God, really? So
wait, they bought it? Your parents
bought it?
Well,
no, no. Let me tell you what happened. My dad accepted the free sample, and they charged him for 2 years, and it was $175 a month. So,
what?
Oh my gosh. Yep. And I tried to find out from my dad, like, how did they get your credit card? And I guess what the deal was, like, they convinced him to give his credit card information with the free supply or whatever. It had to be, because there's no way they just, you know, came up with his credit card. But my dad swore up and down. He's like, I never drank it. I never did anything. I ordered the free sample. My dad orders samples off the TV all the time. Like, you know, it's not uncommon for him to order something that he saw on the TV that he wants to try or whatever. The fact is, they just full on took his credit card, just said, it was probably one of those deals, if you don't cancel, we're just going to charge you.
Yeah.
So I called them up and I freaked on them. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, my dad is retired. He has a limited amount of money. You know, this is ridiculous. You're literally ripping off old people that don't know any better. And I got them to refund up to a year of the charges.
That's
just
something.
1 year. Wow, Jay. Good job.
And by the way, I tasted this stuff. And really, you're selling this? It tastes like crap. Like, I was so, you know, think about it. I know exactly who I'm talking to. I know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, there was no way these guys weren't going to give us money back. I freaked.
Well, good for you.
My father is absolutely not the only person that is experiencing this. There's probably a ton of people that are retired are getting these.
So absolutely, they target older people who are not savvy, maybe not computer savvy, maybe a little, you know, a little slow, a little even early dementia or whatever. They're exploiting vulnerable population in order to sell their snake oil or whatever scam. It's not just snake oil. It's any scam like this.
And oftentimes the big money isn't in selling that stuff, but it's in selling now your dad's name to every other marketer that's selling a similar thing. Because now they know he's a mark.
So, Evan, how did our first experiment with the new Who's That Noisy go?
Well, it was actually quite successful in many, many ways.
Mm-hmm. And filling up my inbox.
Exactly. Little onslaught of email there. But that's good. That was, you know, we're getting people, you know, we're getting people moving. We're getting them to their computers. They're corresponding with us. This is a good thing.
As long as you're in charge of it. Yep.
Yeah, as long as I'm in charge with it, in charge of it. All right. We had a puzzle last week. Let's read it again, shall we? Okay. A jeweler has 9 pearls, which all look and feel exactly alike. However, the jeweler knows that one of them weighs more than the other 8. He has access to a classic scale. This is the one with 2 arms, often seen in Lady Justice's hand. What is the minimum number of measurements required to know with absolute certainty which pearl is the one that weighs more? The answer, do you guys know what the answer is?
2.
Correct,
Steve. Yeah, I think it's 2.
You take 2 sets of 3 pearls and weigh them against each other in the scale. Either you're going to get the group with the heavier pearl, one side's going to outweigh the other, or they're going to weigh the same. In any case, you've identified the group of 3. Well, you've identified either the group of 3 that you didn't weigh as being the one that contains the heavier pearl, if the scales turned out to be equal, or if your scales are offset, then, well, you've look at it, your scale, and you know which set of 3 there is heavier. So you've narrowed it down to 3. Then you take those 3 pearls, and you measure just 2 of those pearls against each other on the scale, and the same process takes place. They're either even, which means the one that's left over is the one that is heavier, or if one outweighs the other, the scales reveal that.
Yep, cool.
So yeah, simple.
It's a good puzzle. It is, in a sense. And we selected, or I should say, I selected at random using a genuine quantum random number generator.
Quantum? Right,
oh, it was quantum. It's so quantum, I don't even know if it was here or there. I took all the winning names. I ran them through the computer, and the computer spit out for us the name Ishai Ben Arroya is the winner of this week's puzzle.
Congratulations,
Ishai. Awesome. Well done. So now, your name goes into the hat for the final drawing, which will occur at the end of the year.
All right, Evan, thank you. What do you got for this week?
All right, for this week, we're going back to the classic Who's That Noisy? I would like the listeners to identify this particular noisy. And here we go.
Possible.
Isto é o poder de Deus. Isto é quem acredita naquele grande arquiteto do universo. Eu nunca curei ninguém. O que cura é Deus.
Ooh.
Interesting. Yeah.
Please go ahead and give us your guess. Now, here's what we're going to do. Starting with this week, we are going to ask to send us your guesses to a brand new email address that we have created specifically for this contest. That email address is wtn@theskepticsguide.org. And of course, WTN stands for Who's That Noisy, which is the name of this segment.
We're going to do a Name That Logical Fallacy this week. I came across a debate on debate.org about creationism. So here's the debate was about the notion that this is about young earth creationism, the notion that the universe is 6 to 10,000 years old. And the person who started the debate said, well, we could disprove that with one line of reasoning. Light from galaxies billions of light years away has reached the earth. The speed of light is a constant, and therefore it must have been traveling for billions of years. Therefore, the universe cannot be 6,000 or whatever years old. The creationist who took the other side, the young earth creationist, countered that with this line of reasoning, which I know you guys have heard before, but this is interesting. They wrote, it's really not that hard to answer those questions no matter what understanding you come from. God, of course, created them full grown to start with. Adam did not have to wait for the trees to grow old enough to bear fruit from a seedling start. God did not create trees as seeds in the ground. And God, according to Genesis, did not create an egg for the first chicken to hatch from. The starting place of growth of all creation is clearly full-grown adulthood. The light-year travel time is clearly, by the same extension, created already reaching the earth. Basically, at the same extension that God created all the matter and energy and photons and the starlight years away, he also simultaneously created every photon from its rays traveling to earth.
Wow, it's impressive.
It's a lot of work.
So there's a number, I think, of serious problems with that line of reasoning. You guys want to take a crack at pointing some of them out?
Well, argument from authority. God, according to Genesis, I mean, that's kind of an authority that you're citing, you know.
Sure. Think about that, Bob. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think there's really, to me, when I read this, I didn't think immediately that there's a logical fallacy. The main problem to me is that it's not falsifiable.
Right.
So if you were to call it, like, it's perfectly logical considering their premise, which is that miracles happen. So
yeah.
when your premise is miracles happen, then it's perfectly logical to say, and then a miracle happened and we win.
Right.
Yeah. So this segment does not necessarily have to be restricted to formal or informal logical fallacies. So there's other things about this argument that's wrong, if you will, or not even wrong, other than being fallacious. But there are definitely a lot of fallacies hiding in there. So the problem with, you know, extending from the, if you take the premise, so maybe we could say this is an unstated major premise, but it's actually pretty out there. I mean, the guy's a fundamentalist young earth creationist, so his premise is there. In any case, it's special pleading, right? Because, you know, what the miracle gives you is an infinite, unhindered ability to special plead any evidence that exists. Because you could always just say, well, it's that way because God made it that way. Why did God make it that way? Who knows? We don't have to know that. We can't know that. But whatever evidence crops up, God made it that way. Arbitrarily, ad hoc, special pleading, unlimited, the wild card that answers all questions.
Right.
Right. So, which is why
anything is fair game, basically.
Yeah. I also think there's a poor analogy in there. I don't think that the analogy between maturity works for light already on its way to Earth or already at Earth. I don't think those are necessarily one flows from the other. Adam was created as an adult, therefore light was created already having traveled down its way to Earth. So that's a not an apt analogy in my opinion.
And also, how do we know Adam was created as an adult?
Well, again, this is taking the premise that Genesis is literally true. Uh-huh. So it's sort of holding it to its own standard. But there's something else in here that I thought of when I was reading this that, again, I'm not sure if it's a logical fallacy so much as thinking through the implications of this line of reasoning. So, or maybe it's an unstated premise in that, so the young earth creationist here is considering only the distance of the galaxies as a problem, but he's ignoring a much bigger problem for the God created the light already at the Earth. It's in that when we're looking out into space,
we're looking back into time.
We're looking back into time. Exactly. We're not just looking at a distance, and that's not the only problem. We're also looking back in time. So think about it. When we look at supernova that are occurring in other galaxies, those are events that took place millions or billions of years ago.
Right.
And therefore, God did not just create light on its way to Earth. He created light from supernova that never occurred, of stars that never existed. In fact, he created an entire fake history of the universe.
Yeah, fake history that is
right,
embedded in every person's mind.
A fake 13.7 billion year old history of the universe that is encoded in all of that light that God created on its way to the Earth already.
Which would require every particle and everything that particle ever did throughout all those billions of years.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The way it was bent by gravity and absorption lines that passed through gas clouds. That's what I said. Entire fake history of the universe, not just the light was mature in that it was already at the Earth. So the argument breaks down incredibly when you think about it that way. This is the God created the world 5 seconds ago argument, right?
Right.
It's the same exact thing. If you could make that same argument, it's unfalsifiable. It's consistent, obviously, with all the evidence, but that's not when you're invoking miracles, being consistent with the evidence is a non-issue. As I said, because you could special plead anything. It's exactly the same thing as saying God created the entire universe 5 minutes ago, but with a fake history of every, including your memories, and all of the evidence of a history was created along with the universe. Same thing. It's exactly the same thing.
And you can't argue it in any way.
Well, you can argue it using, you know, logic, but you can't scientifically investigate it, and you can't disprove it. It's undisprovable. And creationists think, aha, we've won because you can't disprove my position. But they don't realize that by staking out an unfalsifiable position, they are eliminating themselves or removing themselves from the arena of science and knowledge, and are saying that I just believe this arbitrarily as a tenet of my faith.
What are you saying? That's good luck.
Now, this argument is actually so bad, when I was researching it, I found that the Answers in Genesis website, you guys familiar with this?
Oh, yeah.
They mention the light from distant galaxies problem. They bring up this solution, light was created already to the Earth, and they point out that it doesn't work for the same reasons that I just pointed out.
Even Answers in Genesis wow. debunked this already.
Yes, yes, it's debunked by other young Earth creationists. Gosh, such a bad argument. But then, of course, they replace it with an equally bad argument. Do you know what the other thing that creationists say is as the answer to this? Essentially. So they say that, well, you're assuming uniformitarianism. You're assuming that the laws of the universe as we observe them today were always that way, that the speed of light was always the same thing. Maybe light was a billion times faster in the past, and that's how the light arrived at the Earth. So it still compresses a lot of history of the universe into 6,000 years. It still doesn't work. And there are fatal problems with that line of reasoning.
Yeah, the universe wouldn't look the way it looks if
it wouldn't look the way it looks. To the extent that we've been observing the universe as long as we have, the laws have not been shifting over time, the speed of light has not been changing over time. And they even acknowledge these problems, but then just gloss over them. It's like, there are problems with this line of argument. But anyway, you know, they just move on. It's like, okay, there are fatal flaws with your argument, but you're going to use it anyway. Cause it's all about the Answers in Genesis is all about plausible deniability for creationists, for young Earth creationists. That's what it's about.
This is the intellectual equivalent of a 2-year-old throwing a temper tantrum.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's really what it is.
It is intellectually dishonest, childish, naive, and deceptive.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a regular science or fiction this week, no theme. I know you guys all prefer it.
Yay!
No theme. Yeah.
All right, so Steve, I came up with a little test I want to perform with science or fiction.
Okay.
I want to use a die to roll a random number, whatever, if you have 3 or 4 questions, I'll find a die that works. And I want to collect the data of the absolute random guess, and then I'll play the game for, you know, in a normal way, and I'll make my real guess, and we'll see if random chance is better than my actual information that's in my head, my real guess.
Okay, seems like the hard way to do it, but fine. sure. Go ahead, roll your die, give your random guess. Go.
I got a number 3.
Okay.
That's the random for this week.
All right, here we go. Well, here they are. A new study finds that the International Prototype Kilogram, or IPK, has put on about 100 micrograms during its lifetime. Number 2, China is confirmed to have a cyber assassin agents who specialize in killing targets by hacking medical or other technology. And number 3, scientists discover that the Penicillium mold is able to reproduce sexually. So Jay, just for this week, why don't you go first? Meaning I won't make you go first every week because you're doing this, but.
Okay. So the first one, there's a study that finds that the International Prototype Kilogram has put out about 100 micrograms during its lifetime.
Put on, yep.
Put on, whatever.
put out.
Are you saying that the kilogram has gained weight over the years?
Yes.
Okay. Why not? Sure. Maybe they modified it a little bit here and there. There were reasons why they did. And sure, I could see scope creep. Absolutely. The second one is about China confirmed to have cyber assassin agents who specialize in killing targets by hacking medical or other technology. Whoa, that is a movie right there.
Or a video game.
But why would they do it, and who are they trying to kill?
Dun, huh? Dun, dun.
That is so awesome. I have to believe that. I could see now I'm agreeing with the random die generator without even getting to number three. Scientists discover that the penicillium mold is able to reproduce sexually. Now, when you say sexually, Steve, can you show me what you mean with pictures?
Yes. Go, pictures of go to White House. Go
penicillium
to Whitehouse.com.
Jay, I got some bacteria porn. I'll send it to you.
I'm going to assume here that you mean that there is some type of interaction between like the quote-unquote male and quote-unquote female type deal. And a little hip action and bingo, you got a little baby penicillium. I don't know anything about that one. So that's hard for me to comment on.
Hard.
And I've already confirmed that the other two have to be true just because I need them to be. So I'm going to say that the third one about the penicillium is, of course, false. Thank you.
Okay, Rebecca.
When you were reading the thing about the cyber assassin, I thought you were going to say about there's that guy that just hired cyber assassins to kill his son's character in a video game. So I do believe that there are confirmed cyber assassins in that respect, but I don't think that there are cyber assassins who are killing targets by hacking medical technology.
That's, there has to be, Rebecca.
That's
come on.
Crazy talk. That is crazy talk. And also, how would you confirm that? Did China issue a press release? Are we just believing that? Like, I don't.
They found a ninja assassin crawling through the cable work. I mean, come on.
I agree with Jay that it would make a remarkable movie, but I don't think that it's real life.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the kilogram. I could see that because there's definitely been a shift in trying to make certain measurements, certain metric measurements, derivable from physics and not something that, you know, is based on, here's this kilogram thing that we made 30 years ago and everything is based off of this, where you're definitely going to get errors from that over time. But if you can derive what, you know, based on an equation, exactly what it weighs, then that's definitely better. And I think that makes perfect sense that they would do that. The third one, the penicillium mold. Yeah, I guess I'm having some problems with that, but I do know of some organisms that can switch from asexual to sexual reproduction. I guess it wouldn't surprise me that maybe they could do that occasionally. But yeah, like Rebecca, I've got problems with the cyber assassin. Yeah, how did we find out? What they would never admit it, although you don't say they admitted it, but it is confirmed. And how would you even know that China was behind it? I mean, couldn't it be something else, some organization or something within China, not necessarily, you know, China itself is behind it. And I think the targets would just be too limited. You know, how many people that do you want to take out, you know, have medical tech that's even hackable? I think it's something that could definitely happen in the future. And it probably could happen now, but I just don't think it's worth the effort to really pull off. Yeah, I got a lot of problems with that one. So I'll say that one's fiction.
And Evan,
the mold, I don't, you know, reproduce sexually. Okay. Under certain circumstances, certain temperature, certain, you know, arrangements, maybe. China is confirmed. Yeah, that was the one part that got me. How do we confirm that with China? There's so much about China we can't confirm. How do we confirm this, of all things? Cyber assassins. Assassin's Creed 4, right? Chinese cyber assassins, something like that. So video games. Nope, it's not the cyber assassins. That one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that a new study finds that the International Prototype Kilogram, IPK, has put on about 100 micrograms during its lifetime is science. You guys all think that. And that one is science.
Yes,
good
it
job.
Is.
Although you guys, your discussion of this item was off.
Really?
Yeah. So you're all right for the wrong reason. So
that happens.
Well, I'm right because I read it. So
yeah, you didn't say anything about it. But the prototype kilogram, the International Prototype Kilogram, is an actual physical object.
Oh,
that
right.
That is
right.
The standard. It is the prototype.
Yeah.
This was set in 1875. The first IPK was made in 1884. There are 40 official replicas of the IPK. So around the world, so that everyone has the same kilogram.
So how to gain weight?
It's the only measurement left that's based upon an arbitrary physical item, not, as Bob said, derivable from some physical law or property. So all the other ones are something that can be derived from something physical. So you don't need an actual prototype or a representation. So it's very important that these prototype kilograms are stable over time. Do you guys know what they're made out of?
Lead.
Imagine something like lead or
silver or platinum.
Platinum. Good, Bob. Made of platinum.
So smart, Bob. Wow.
Something not reactive. However,
Thanksgiving.
What Professor Peter Compson and Dr. Naoko Sano have discovered is that they basically examined a similar item. And they found that it builds hydrocarbons on its surface over time, and they estimate that the IPK has probably about 100 micrograms of hydrocarbons built up on its outer surface over the last 100 and whatever 30 years.
You're saying it builds the hydrocarbons?
Yeah, it builds up on it's got schmutz on the outside of
schmutz.
It. Schmutz,
so, okay.
Yeah, so it's 100 micrograms of contaminants have built up on the outside of the IPK.
Literally, do they just have to, like, hose it down or dust it, or what's going on?
Clorox wipe or something.
You gotta be careful because you don't want to wipe away any platinum atoms and reduce its weight.
Just put more schmutz on.
Yeah, but then you've then messed around with
it's
the standard.
It's already messed around.
So, but they discovered that you can get rid of those hydrocarbons without damaging the platinum, without damaging the prototype itself by using
ginkgo biloba.
By using essentially shining certain frequencies of light onto it.
Oh, awesome. So they're polishing it with light.
Yeah, essentially.
Oh, kind of like those.
That's not what Thomas Kincaid did.
UV and ozone.
It's like those
exposing the surface to a mixture of UV and ozone, you can remove the carbonaceous contamination and potentially bring prototype kilograms back to their ideal weight.
How'd they find out that it was not right anymore? I mean,
they investigated. Yeah, because they have to weigh it again. They just showed that a similar item built up this contaminant over time. They were able to identify it using an X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, or XPS, to analyze surfaces similar to the standard kilogram to assess the buildup of hydrocarbons. And then they figured out how to remove them.
Oh, now we have to put this thing in a safe place where it won't build up these hydrocarbons.
Well, it is. This is, despite all of the efforts to keep it in a very controlled, safe environment so that this doesn't happen, it still happened to this degree.
Can you see a maid walking by this thing?
Dusting
it. She spits on it and shines it and buffs it.
Sprays polish on it, yes.
There you go.
All right, well, I guess we'll take these in order. Number two, China is confirmed to have cyber assassin agents who specialize in killing targets by hacking medical or other technology. Jay thinks this one is science. The rest of you think this one is fiction.
Come on, Steve.
Now, what is so implausible about the United States, our own spies, figuring out that they're doing this, and then some politician saying, we cannot afford a cyber assassin gap?
Thank you. Exactly.
If a
right?
politician exactly. said it, I think that would have been splashed on the headlines.
But this one is the fiction. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Come on, Jay.
Cool,
don't you know Steve by now?
Stupid die.
I'm not going to be able to go to bed tonight knowing that there are no ninja assassins trying to kill people through the internet.
You could be the first one, Jay.
Yeah, there's a job opening.
So, but when I was investigated, this was Rebecca. I was inspired by the dad who hired cyber assassins in World of Warcraft to kill his son's avatar, not just
awesome.
Once, but every time he logged on, they killed him. They whacked him.
I love that story because what a great job would that be? Like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I murder people in video games. Their parents pay me.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Evan, you have to meet them in game in like a dark bar. And you have to like walk in and the guy's smoking like a, French cigarette. And he's like, can I do for you? There's a whole exchange that you gotta like have the secret password and all that stuff.
Anyway, so I looked, I had to make sure that this wasn't real before I did some internet searching on cyber assassin. And there are some websites out there that claim that there are confirmed cyber assassin attacks that have occurred, but they're really not confirmed. They're the vague, no name, no details, no good sources, So I couldn't find any confirmed assassinations that occurred using any of these cyber methods. Although
JFK, number one.
Although it did happen on the series Homeland this season. I won't give you any spoilers if there was a cyber assassination that occurred on Homeland. All right, which means that scientists discover that penicillium mold is able to reproduce sexually is science.
That's sweet.
Yep, contrary to 100 years of belief, this is the first time it's been demonstrated. It wasn't easy to do. They had to put
play soft music, light a candle.
Yeah, put them in the right mood, the right situation. You had to create certain conditions in terms of temperature and nutrients, etc., and then the scientists were able to coax them into reproduce sporing sexually. So most of the time, fungus and molds, they spore asexually, right? They just a single parent, just buds and spores, and that's it. That's how they reproduce. So they're essentially producing clones of themselves. But there have been other observations, of other fungi that do occasionally will reproduce sexually, which does cause a recombination of genes and you get new characteristics. But this is the first time it's been demonstrated for the penicillium mold, which is the one that makes penicillin. And this could lead to the production of new drugs, apparently, I guess. Or maybe just new ways of producing penicillin. So the product of the sexual reproduction did have new traits and abilities. It was different. So
sweet.
So far, I'm 1-1 with Chance.
That's right. Bob and Evan are at 100%. Rebecca and Jay are at 50% so far this year. I'm not going to keep track of this more than for a couple of weeks.
It's like getting up to bat in the first game and getting two hits in the first game. Okay, great.
Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Lieutenant Commander Data said something very profound on
Woohoo!
Star Trek The Next Generation Season 2, episode Where Silence Has Lease. And this quote was sent in by Shane Powell. Captain, the most elementary and valuable statement in science, the beginning of wisdom, is, I do not know.
Lieutenant Commander Data, played by Brent Spiner!
Great character.
Oh, I loved him.
Jordy the Forge tweeted at me the other day.
No, awesome.
Yes, how's LeVar? How's my buddy?
He's got the Reading Rainbow coming back.
Oh, is he coming back with Reading Rainbow? Oh,
that's what I hear.
Time to have a kid.
So we have the first skeptical conference of the year coming up, Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. One addition to the schedule, now is a good time, by the way, to get your tickets. You can get the ticket for the whole weekend or just Saturday or just Sunday. And we have a number of workshops on Friday. We just completed the list of workshops by adding one that will be run by George Fraub. And me, George and I are going to run a workshop together. It's called How to Use Podcasting for Social Activism. So it's going to be a discussion of the use of social media in general, but with an emphasis on podcasting, but also supporting social media like blogs and Twitter and Facebook and all the other stuff, for whatever your goal is, however you want to go out there.
Will
and
there
change
be songs?
The world. George is involved, so I'm assuming that there probably will be some singing at some point.
I'll be there.
Not by me. So we'll have some good discussion of just the big questions about, how to use it. But also we'll drill down to some of the technical details for those who are interested in really how to do this. Like, what are the little things you need to know to get a podcast up and running? All the stuff that we learned the hard way over the years. So it should be a lot of fun. Those workshops are very limited in terms of their seating. So you really do want to get them. If you want to go attend any of the workshops, I do recommend that you sign up early because I think they're going to sell out pretty quickly. We've already sold out the live show that we have on Saturday.
Awesome.
Gone.
Yeah, a few days.
Maybe some scalpers on the street, though. You never know.
Cool. Yeah, never know.
I'm really looking forward to it. I love those live shows, and I'm looking forward to Nexus this year. We have great speaker lineup. Malidnov. I think I could say his name now. Malidnov.
Yeah, Lidnov.
Leonard Malidnov.
Yeah.
Is our keynote, and he's pretty awesome. You've got to hear him talk. Also, just go to nexus.org, necss.org for more information and for registration.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.